The poems of David Murrah are not pretty, and neither are the angels in his newest collection, Angels for the Burning. His angels live at the margins of our cities, our culture, our history, and our politics. A Laotian kid who shoots a man across a convenience store counter, an unknown kid mistakenly gunned down in a city park while playing basketball, an Asian American jazz musician trying to make sense of his father's death and the racism that framed his family's life. Walter Benjamin once said, "History is the tale of the victors." But in poem after poem, Murrah voices their unvictorious stories for them. Though some are murderers and thieves, others victims of crimes, Murrah makes them all not beautiful, but more importantly, heard, and finally, deeply human. The underlying theme in nearly every poem in Murrah's work is race. Whether that theme is told with rage or humor, bemusement or compassion, whether it is the stories of urban immigrants or Japanese Americans writing from an internment camp during World War II, or even his own daughter, a Hapa, a person of mixed race, shopping at Abercrombie and Fitch, David Murrah never sacrifices simple, straightforward, and unflinching language. As fellow poet Martin Espada says, David Murrah is an honest poet, a truth seeker, and a truth teller. And the truth Murrah wants to tell is too important to gussy up with pretty words and phrases. This is not to say that Murrah lacks eloquence and elegance, but looking down the right margins of his poems, especially the longer pieces, we are reminded of Melville's remark, "The uncompromising truth can only be told with some ragged edges." Even in his most lyrical moments, he is often raw and uncompromising. Poet, creative nonfiction writer, critic, playwright, and performance artist, David Murrah is the author of 6 books, including 2004's poetry collection, Angels for the Burning. His second book of poetry, The Colors of Desire, won the Carl Sandburg Literary Award, and his first collection, After We Lost Our Way, won the 1989 National Poetry Series Contest. Murrah has also written 2 memoirs, Turning Japanese, Memoirs of a Sansei, which won a 1991 Joseph Miles Book Award from the Oakland Pen and was listed in the New York Times Notable Books of the Year, and Where the Body Meets Memory, an odyssey of race, sexuality, and identity. Among his awards are a Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Award, a U.S.-Japan Creative Artist Exchange Fellowship, NEA Fellowships, Bush Fellowships, and Loft McKnight Writers Awards. He lives in Minneapolis with his wife and 3 children. We're in for a real treat tonight, and I'm proud to welcome to our podium David Murrah.
Thank you, Richard, for that wonderful introduction. And it's a pleasure to be here. And I want to thank the Poetry Society of St. Louis, St. Louis Poetry Society
Center
for, and the River Styx for bringing me here. I've had a great visit. The first poem I'm going to read is called Minneapolis Public. And for those of you who've listened to Garrison Keillor's Prairie Home Companion, You might have a certain picture of what Minneapolis, my hometown, is like, which is really inaccurate. And even people of color have this picture of Minneapolis is all white. Chris Rock has this, you know, in one of his concert films, he talks about Minneapolis, the only white people there are Kevin Garnett and Prince. The only black people, excuse me, are there, but Kevin Garnett and Prince. But in actuality, because of the recent waves of immigration, it's a very different city. And so this is a poem called Minneapolis Public, which is about the school my kids go to. And there's a little dig here on the anthology of American Buddhist poetry, because there's not one Asian American in that anthology. And this also makes reference to that Garrison Keillor saying where he says, Lake Wobegon, where the women are strong and men good-looking and the children above average. Okay. Minneapolis Public. There are 150 first languages in our schools. And so many aliens, even E.T., would go unnoticed. Though if your tongue moved one way in the land of your birth, it must move another now, awkward at first. There are blacks here who've never been to Africa. Africans who've never heard a Baptist prayer, much less the solemn dirges of Lutherans, or how the artist formerly known as some sort of prince. In the anthology of American Buddhist poetry, you will find not one face of a Tibetan, but they are here with girls and boys named Tenzin, and one, my son's good friend, throws a hard, mean spiral. Esmir is not the name of a girl, but a Bosnian boy who crouches at a lamp and at a table and glues a lamp together, and later with my other son conspires on a book, a touch of rabies, a heartbreaking tale of good dogs gone bad. Why tell a soul of the sieges that brought him here? Or stories of the Dalai Lama, or the temples destroyed, or troops of the warlords in the streets of Somalia, the borders dividing death from safety, if not evil, from good. Say you're Egyptian or Haitian. Here you're singular, not part of a Big Apple ghetto. If you're Chinese, most likely you're adopted, or else your parents study engineering at the U. And have I mentioned the Mexicans? In West Side Story, the rumble starts with Puerto Ricans and working class whites in a high school gym. This year's play, Maria's still Natalie Wood White to Jamaica's half-black Anita. And the Jets sport blacks, one Tibetan, and my Hoppa daughter, who still doesn't question such casting. Or why Bye Bye Birdie last year just might not be the choice of half the school for a song and dance they could take on as their own. Still, at the school spring dance, J-Lo and Ja Rule set the awkward bump and grind of junior high girls, and the boys watch on the sidelines, as boys that age do, whether Bosnian, black, white, Somali, Tibetan. I'm told we live in the land of Great Lake Wobegon, where all the women are good, are strong, the men good-looking, and the children above average. And I always add, everyone's white. Hey, Tenzin, Nabil, go tell Garrison. Not now, not quite. Thank you. I wasn't going to read this poem, but I will because Richard mentioned it and because he had asked me, he knew from one of my memoirs that I played basketball, and he wondered if I wanted to do a pickup game yesterday, and I told him, well, my days of playing have gone past. But this is about an incident that happened in a park near my house where a boy was shooting baskets, and he got caught up in some, by mistake, in some gangland thing going down. It's called The Angel of Phillips Park. Two crows in the alley garbage, shrieking and scuffling at a leg bone or stale egg sandwich. And the night impatient takes them down, the raucous throats and wing flurry now silent. Night of the first lilacs, just after a strong spring rain, wiping out for a few hours the dealers at the corner, fists in their baggy pants, Nikes sliding the walk, black hoods or knit caps, bleary eyes catching it all. In the park on Franklin, outside the Four Winds School, the last kid on the scholarship of his mind pops the airs with arcs, tray after tray, counting the final seconds of the game. And the crowd roars in his ears like the ocean he's never seen. And just as he hits the top of the key, the first shot steals through his sternum, then one through his shooting hand, so quick pulling the trigger. and it flows from the poorest spot, draining his belly like a black hole in the heavens. And on this court where he always won and gave it all, his body topples in a puddle. So epic and slow in its fall, some bit of his brain still hot made it nothing but net. Silence now, stepping through the wet grass, held in check till the flashing lights and the tires of the city's finest screech to the tennis courts. Static on the radio, miking 10-4 breaking up. The crows start at it again. And no one sees one crow rising higher and higher on wings of blackness and prayer, a jam so devastating and powerful, redeeming all the light in this universe and giving it back as a crow, a knight, a boy, a star. Thank you. My parents and my grandparents were, both their families were interned, and during World War II, when they rounded up 20,000 Japanese Americans and put them in these concentration camps throughout the Western United States. One of the things about this, I've been thinking about this recently, is how very ordinary things that the Japanese Americans did or said or had suddenly after Pearl Harbor became very sinister. In the same way, for many Arab Americans, certain things that they did or said or had in their communities or in their homes suddenly became proof that they were suspicious or even spies. One Japanese American was arrested immediately after World War II broke out because he had a cup from the Japanese government for being a good businessman. And then he had a map of the Panama Canal. And the FBI thought he was going to blow up the Panama Canal. And even when he told them, I didn't even draw that map. It was drawn by my kid for school. They said, you know, you have to prove to us that you're not going to blow up the Panama Canal. And as his son, who would talk about this, said, you can't prove that you're not going to do something you're not going to do. So they rounded up the leaders of the Japanese American community immediately after World War II broke out. And so this man is writing to his wife, who's in another internment camp, who's kept separate from him. And he makes a reference to a biwa, which is a Japanese stringed instrument that his friend plays. And his friend is bruised because sometimes the Japanese Americans fought among themselves about how to respond to the government, whether to protest or go along with the government's orders. So he's writing this letter to his wife in another camp. It's called Letters from Tule Lake Internment Camp, 1942-45. Dear Michiko, do songs sound different in prison? I think there are no spaces between the words. I think when the song ends, silence does not stop singing. I think there is nothing but song. Matsuo's back. His bruises almost healed, a tooth missing. His biwa comes out again with the stars, a nightly matter. He sends his regards. Do you get fed these putrid gray beans? I hope you haven't swallowed too many of them. They put my stomach in a permanent revolt, shouting, no emperor should ever feed his people so harshly. I agree. Let's you and I grow skinny together. Let's keep the peace. Any second, the lights will go out. I look around and see many honest men who hide their beauty as best they can.
I think that's what the whites hate, our beauty, the way we carry the life of plants inside us, seedlings and fruit, flowers and the flush tree, fields freed of weeds. What? Why can't they see the doors inside them? Sir, if someone found an answer to that, they would find an answer to why those who are hungry and cold go off to battle to become hungrier and colder, farther from home. 9 o'clock. The lights all out. Sometimes, Michiko, I think of my greenhouse. How I used to stand at night in its fleshy, steaming dark and say, these are the most beautiful orchids and roses in the world. And the fragrance seeped inside me, stayed even when I sold them. What is it like now in Tokyo? They say it is sunk like a great ship. Forgive me. Blessed with a chance to talk to my wife, more beautiful than any greenhouse rose, all I can do is moan. And yet, if I didn't tell you, I would be angry at you for not listening, blaming you for what I haven't spoken. And it's too late for that. When you write back, Michiko, please tell me what country I'm in. I feel so poor now. These words are all I own.
This is a little poem from my newest book, which is about an experience that somebody in my family knew who, after he got out of the internment camps, underwent a psychological test as part of getting out and getting a new job or something. So this is about his reaction after getting out of the internment camps to this psychological test. It's called Internment Camp Psychology, circa 1945. Just after his release, Moss took a psychological test. Three questions he never forgot. Do you think people are out to get you? Do you feel you are being followed? When you see a crowd of strangers walking towards you, do you try to avoid them? To all three, he answered yes, and knew he sounded insane. This is a little piece I did, which is a mixture of a performance piece and then a poem in my latest book. And I'm going to go back and forth twice between two characters. And the first character is Martin Chan, and his brother is Martin Yan. This doesn't make any sense, but it's just the way these things, stereotypes run. Martin Yan, and do you know who Martin Yan is? Martin Yan is the guy who does the PBS cooking show, Yan Can Cook. Now, he speaks on this show with a Chinese accent, with a pretty thick Chinese accent. And then I met somebody who met Martin Yan, and it says his accent is... he doesn't have much of an accent at all. So the question is, why does he speak with an accent on TV? So his brother has a show which explains why his brother talks this way. And he has, it's also a show partially because as an Asian American actor, and this used to be particularly true, and it's getting a little bit better, you always had to play like something like my friend Kelvin Han Yi. He would get offers for roles like, he's the Chinese cook that gets run over by Sean Connery as he's chasing the villain through the kitchen, and he's supposed to just yell at him in Chinese after he gets, you know, or in a fake Chinese accent after he gets run over. So the second character is a young Chinese-Vietnamese man who's came to this country as a young boy and had to learn how to speak English. And he talks about how scary it was to have to translate for his parents as he gets older. So there's these two characters.
Nam Sikko! Welcome! I am Martin Chan, and I would like to welcome you to Chan Can Talk! This is a show where I make the Chinese accent work for you! Because if Chan can't talk, neither can you! Listen to this English with that spicy all-you-can-eat flavor! Because after I talking to you for a half hour with this thick Chinese accent, you don't understand a darn what I'm saying! Oh, but if you're Asian American actor, you must do accents. You must have that flavor. Okay, listen up, class. Darlene in Stain stays mainly in the plane.
Okay, man, let me get my motivation. Darlene in Stain stays mainly in the plane.
No. Darlene in Stain stays mainly in the plane.
Okay, man, let me try it again.
Darlene in Spain stays mainly in the plane. By golly, I think he's got it. See, just let me teach you. It's so simple. Chan can talk.
I am 9, sitting in a circle with our teacher. Time to read out loud. Though I know these words, ball, the I throw, boy, girl, they lodge in my throat, dry as cotton balls, a cough that won't leave. My teacher wears a look of concern or impatience. It doesn't matter. My classmates giggle or shift in boredom. It doesn't matter. The words lie like ammunition on the page. I will not fire them. The minutes pass. The day is long. Finally, my teacher asks the next student to read on. We were Chinese from Sadek, just outside of Saigon. We escaped on a boat so heavy with people we had to throw our luggage overboard. Deep at night that first winter in America, I lay in the cupola of my sheets and rubbed my hands together, half in prayer, half like two sticks praying for fire. Like those who took us in as sponsors on Sunday, I was asking for the Holy Spirit to speak in tongues of flame.
Martin Yan is my brother. Yan can cook, but he can talk too. Oh, he could lose that Chinese accent, but then he would lose that flavor. And who would watch the darn show? Oh, I know what you're saying, but Martin Yan, he don't talk right. He is a stereotype. Ancient Chinese secret. Americans understand stereotypes. Housewives, Home Alone, and Peoria think his accent is cute, non-threatening, like little Pekingese. Woo! 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 No bark. No bite.
I knew I spoke with an accent. It was visible as a hump or the limp my sister walks with, the metal braces that reverberate with her steps. The noise that emptied from my mouth contained a color I could not eradicate, a grating sing-song like horsehair of a violin, a Chinese violin. And even as I opened my mouth, I could see in the eyes of a listener, if they were white, spreading in every direction across their face, a judgment as inevitable as at evening comes the descending night. And comely noise, ugly noise, ching-chong Chinaman noise, cavity-ridden and sounding of brown gums, yellow teeth, contorted lips struggling like some ape to speak. And unlike the splinter, my father drew with delicacy from my palm,
removing a pain I'd lived with all the day down the streets of the city, the graffiti and traffic. There was nothing my father could do, nor my mother. The words sat in my tongue like the questions that sat inside my ear. What'd you say? What did he say? And yet, even then I was moving away, coming to the time when I would stand before my teacher and translate to my parents both the praise which I embellished and the checks which I altered. Fights on the asphalt schoolyard and a rumbling in my stomach that spoke incessantly of fear. Deep in a magical jungle in some country we traveled to, my parents were wandering, and I had to lead them in the grosses before the lawyer, my teacher, to meaning, sweet land of comprehension, rising like an island before the chaos of oceans, back in the beginning when God made the word and the world. You children, you who take your foreign parents into these unfamiliar streets know this trembling, this fear. And even though you speak for them, you cannot speak your fear. But the minutes pass. The day is long. And it almost vanished like the words I spoke as a child once upon a time, long ago. Boy, ball. Throw me. I'm going to read two sections from the title poem to my second book. And this is called The Colors of Desire. And the first section is called Photograph of a Lynching. And it starts with a photograph of a lynching. And then it goes to my father getting on a... He's getting out of... When the Japanese Americans were in the internment camps in the South, after a while they would get out, be able to get out in a day-long pass. And they would get on a bus to go to... My dad was in Jerome, Arkansas, and they get on the bus to go to see a movie in Little Rock. And the bus was segregated. And the question is, where did the Japanese Americans sit? And I asked my father, he said, we sat where the whites sat. And he said, you know, I said, when you went to the movies, he said, we sat below the balcony where the whites sat. And there's a way in which I have a long sort of talk that I do about this, which I won't give you now, but it has to do with the way in which Asian Americans have been allowed in certain instances to be honorary whites. But part of the agreement in doing this is we're not supposed to claim connections with the people in the back of the bus. We're not supposed to protest what's happening to the people in the back of the bus. Because the minute we begin to do that, then we break that bargain about being honorary white. So, and then the last image in this section of the poem is I'm watching this early pornographic film from the 70s called Behind the Green Door, which has at the center a black man and a white woman. And then I'm wondering, you know, where I fit in all this. The Colors of Desire, photograph of a lynching circa 1930. These men, in their dented felt hats, in the way their fingers tug their suspenders or vests, with faces a bit puffy or too lean, eyes narrow and close together, they seem too like our image of the South, the 30s. Of course, they are white. Who then could create this cardboard figure, face flat and gray, eyes oversized, bulging like an ancient totem this gang has dug up?
at the far right in a small brown cap. A boy of 12 smiles, as if responding to what's most familiar here. The cameras click. And though directly above them a branch ropes the dead Negro in the air, the men too focus their blank beam on the unseen eye, which is at this moment us. Or more precisely, me, who cannot but recall how my father, as a teenager, clutched his weekend pass, passed through the rifle towers and gates of the Jerome, Arkansas camp, in 1942 stepped on a bus to fight white riders motioning, "Sit here, son." And in the rows beyond, a half dozen black faces waving him back. Us colored folks got to stick together. How did he know where to sit? And how is it 35 years later I found myself sitting in a dark theater watching behind the green door with a dozen anonymous men? On the screen, a woman sprawls on a table, stripped naked. The same woman is on the ivory snow soapbox, a baby on her shoulder, smiling her blonde, practically pure white smile. Now, after being prepared and serviced slowly by a handful of women, she is ready. And now he walks in. Lean, naked, black. Streaks of white paint on his chest and face, a necklace of teeth. It's almost comical, this fake garb of the jungle, Africa and all America, black and blonde, almost a joke, but for the surge of what these lynchers urge as the ultimate crime against nature. The black man kneeling to this white body, slipping himself in. The screen showing it all down to her head, shaking in the seizure. The final screen before he lifts himself off her quivering body. I left that theater bolted from a dream into a dream. I stared at the cars whizzing by, watched the light change red, yellow, green. And the haze in my head from the hash of the haze in my head from the image melded together, reverberating. I don't know what I did afterwards. Only night after night I will see those bodies, black and white. And where am I, the missing third? Like a talisman, a rageful, unrelenting release. 2, 1957. This is about an incident outside a grocery store, and then it shifts to my bedroom at night in a fight my brother and I have. 1957. Cut to Chicago, June, a boy of 6. Next year, my hero will be Mickey Mantle. But this noon, as father eases the Bel Air past Wilson, with cowboy hat black, cocked at an angle, my skin dark from the sun, I'm Paladin, the gunslinger. And my 6 guns pointed cars whizzing past, blast after blast, ricocheting the glass. Like all boys, my face attempts a look of what? Toughness, bravado, ease. Until impatient, my father's arm wails across the seat. And I sit back, silent at last. Later, as we step from the grocery store with our sacks, a man in a serge suit, stained with ink, steps forward, shouts, "Hey, you a Jap? You from Tokyo? You a Jap? A chink?" I stop. Look up. I don't know him. Suddenly the sidewalk's rolling, buckling like lava melting, and I know father will explode. Shouts, fist, I know his temper. And then I'm in that dream where nothing happens. The ignition grinds. The man's face presses against the windshield. And father stares ahead, fingers rigid on the wheel. That night in my bedroom, maws like fingertips peck the screen. Down the hall from the living room, there's a muffled TV. As I imagine Shane stepping into the dusty street, in the next bed, my younger brother starts to taunt. You can't hurt me. You can't hurt me. Who can explain where this chant began? Or why, when father throws the door open, shouts, stalking chaos erupted in his house. He swoops on his son with the same swift motion that the son, like an animal, like a scared and angry little boy, fell on his brother, beating him in the dark. Think what I should do. I'll do a couple more things. Oh well. This is one that I've forgotten my hachimaki, which is your headband. So I'm going to use my sunglasses instead. This is about a Chinese actor who came over from Hong Kong to be here. Yeah, that's right. You've seen me before. I'm the Oriental Thug. Got a black belt in karate, aikido, studying under the descendant of a Shaolin master. I can break boards, concrete bricks, blocks of ice. I can throw a bladed star from 20 feet and slit open your nose. I can do backflips, front flips, kips, iron crosses. But when I come to America, I get my ass kicked. Yep, by some middle-aged, over-the-hill, pansy-ass white guy. You know, like Mel Gibson or Chuck Norris or David Carradine. David Carradine, the guy's got dentures by now. His colon's as slow as a Los Angeles freeway. He lives in a senior citizen center over in Bel Air. And I'm supposed to let him kick the crap out of me? Man, you should see the director on those scenes. David, Lee's over to your right. Yes, just a little further. Can you see him? Can you hear me, David? David, put your hearing aid in. David, I know, I don't have to shout. Okay, let's do a leg kick now, David. David, you have to lift up your leg. Man, David Carradine blowing me away? That's like Muhammad Ali getting knocked from the ring by Mr. Zulu. Like Fiji vaporizing the United States in an atomic war. Like Yan Ken Cook mangling Stone Cold Steve Austin. So what happened, Steve? Oh, that man, I couldn't even do nothing against this sweet and sour pork. Forget Hulk Hogan or the human machine, that Yan, he can cook. He's the real ultimate warrior. But I know. This is America. America, not Hong Kong. But, you know, it's not just the whites. I mean, I get here from Hong Kong and it's so strange. All the Asians here, once they make some money, they act just like white people. You know, they buy Barbie dolls for their kids. They wear clothes from Gap. They eat Pizza Hut. Do you know most Asians are lactose intolerant? So what do they do when they get here? They eat great gobs of cheese. I mean, it's like the longer we're here, the more sight of tofu makes us sick. What's that all about? You know what kind of musicals we go to? Yeah, Phantom of the Opera. That's right, you got people from ancestors from Toisan or Guangzhou, and they're up there weeping for some frog guy with a plate on his face. A plate on his face. Well, maybe that's because their daughters are all getting eye surgery and nose and breast enlargements and lip implants. Listen, I'll clue you in. Asians are not supposed to have big lips. Mick Jagger's supposed to have big lips. Barry White's supposed to have big lips. And girls, Asians are not supposed to have large breasts. Dolly Parton, Anna Nicole Smith, Aretha Franklin, yeah. But anyone named Lee or Chow or Nakamura or Fee, they're supposed to have slanted eyes. They're supposed to have small breasts. You know, like you remember when Christy Yamaguchi was doing those
eyelid contact ads, you know, with green contacts. You know what happens when we see a green-eyed person back in Asia? You know what we do? Run! Run! It's a demon! Yeah. The thing I know is, you know, these people, I mean, a lot of them converted to Christianity. Okay, Christianity. You know, they believe some Jewish guy born 2,000 years ago is the Son of God. Now, I understand this. If your ancestors come from France or Germany, you know, but if your ancestors come from the Middle Kingdom or the mountains of Siam, you know, wouldn't you just go, well, you know, more than half the world are Asians and white people are a tiny minority. You know, why wouldn't God pick a Asian to be his son? Or maybe God fucked up, you know? Maybe he made all those Asians as a mistake, you know, and that's why they're having to get eye surgery and breast enlargements and lip implants. I know, but I'm getting into dangerous material here. Anyway, it got so bad I even thought about going back to Hong Kong. But then the other day I turned in international NPV, and guess who's number two in China? Kenny G. You know, not John Coltrane, Charlie Parker, Kenny G. And the thing is, you know, you don't see white people go around being ashamed of Kenny G. No, they go merrily on their way. You know, I mean, I get all these people calling me gook and blaming me for Vietnam. You know, I come from Hong Kong, but what do they care? You know, but I don't see people of color going up to white people and going, pow, honky, that's for Kenny G. Pow, that's for John Bon Jovi. Pow, that's for Britney Spears. You know, they act like, no way. I mean, you know, Kenny G, the dude's number two in China. Explain that to me. Well, you know, anyone hear of the word imperialism? Yeah, I know, you're thinking, but how does a Hong Kong Kung Fu guy know about imperialism? Well, anybody hear of the word British Empire? You know, sometimes I think I should just quit this acting thing, this Oriental thug thing, and become a real thug. Then I could kick some ass, some real ass. But before I do that, you know who I'd waste first? David Carradine. And after that, Kenny G. For those of you who don't know, David Carradine is one of the reasons why Bruce Lee left America. He thought up the series Kung Fu, and he thought he was going to star in it. And when they put David Carradine as a star, he goes, I'm not going to make it in this country. And he went to Hong Kong. And maybe that was a good thing, because he became an international star. Okay. You know, them's fighting words. Them's fighting words. Them's fighting words. I'll end. This is. When my wife was pregnant with our first child, I was so obsessed with it that I made a tape of my own voice. And I had her put the headphones on her belly so that the baby would be used to my voice as well as my wife's voice. So this is a poem where I'm listening to, I picture an ancestor of mine in my grandparents' home village listening to his wife's belly. And the images are all from things happening around my grandparents' home village. It's called Listening. And from that village, steaming with mist, riddled with rain, from the fishermen in the bay hauling up nets of silver flecks, from the droning of the Buddhist priest in the morning, incense thickening his voice, a bit otherworldly, almost sickly, from the oysters ripped from the sea bottom by half-naked women, their skin darker than the bark in the woods, their lungs as endless as some cave where a demon dwells. Soon their harvest will be split open by a blade, moist, meaty flesh drenched in the smell of sea bracken, the tidal winds. From the Torii gate halfway up the mountain and the steps to the temple where the gong shimmers with echoes of bright metallic sound. From the waterfall streaming, hovering in the eye, and an illusion rising. From the cedars that have nothing to do with time. From the small mud-cramped streets of rice shops and fishmongers, from the pebbles on the riverbed, the aquamarine stream, floating pine trunks felled upstream by men with hachimaki tied round their forehead and grunts of yosho, I remember from my father in childhood. From this mythical land of the empty sign and a thousand, thousand manners, on the tip of this peninsula, far from Kyoto, the shogun's palace. In a house of shoji and clean-cut pine, crawling onto a straw dong. One of my ancestors lay his head, as I do now, on a woman's belly, and felt an imperceptible bump, like the bow of a boat hitting the swell. And wondered how anything so tiny could cause such rocking, unbroken joy. Thank you.